Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 134. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two movies that I saw on Saturday. The first one is a fantasy film from the early 1950s called Pandora and the Flying Dutchman, starring James Mason and Ava Gardner. And then another movie I saw on the very same day, and I'll explain why in a moment. And that one is The Death and Life of Otto Bloom, an Australian science fiction movie from a couple of years ago. So let me get the contact details out of the way, and we can start talking about why I saw both of those movies on the same day and how I liked them. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so how is everybody going? I've been very creative lately. I did something really silly over the weekend, and silly, not in necessarily in a bad way, but in a kind of creative way. What I did was this, for the YouTube channel, which I'm really enjoying, I decided I was going to watch 12 movies in a 24-hour period, and I did. Actually, it took 23 hours because you can't exactly make things work out precisely by, picking 12 films and then going, okay, well, it's going to take me 24 hours because movies take roughly 2 hours. In the real world, it doesn't work like that. You've got to take food breaks. You've got to take toilet breaks. You've got to let cats in and out of the house. You've got to say hello to your wife occasionally. So it worked out at 23 hours, and I was kind of happy with that. So if you go over to the YouTube channel, you can check that one out. And it was a lot of fun to record, but toward the end it got a little bit trying because there were movies I really wanted to pay close attention to, but I didn't have any attention left after 20 to 22 hours of solidly watching films. But I've vlogged it and got it done and pieced it all together over the last couple of days, and I'm kind of happy with the way it turned out. There's a little bit of shaky cam when I'm holding the phone because I recorded some of it on the high-definition telephone I have. And some of the shaky cam there is a little bit worrying. But I kind of like the creative little bits and pieces I've done with it. Throwing Jack the Cat in as a secondary character was a lot of fun. And I don't think I'm ever going to do anything like that again because 24 hours is a stretch. And the next day after I finished, Sal and I went over to help a friend pack for a move. So I kind of went from doing the 24, finishing that at 6 o'clock in the morning, getting some sleep, going to sleep that night, and the next day I was rushing around filling up boxes, and it knocked me around a little bit, to be honest. So I'm not going to do that again, but I may do other challenges as far as movies are concerned. And I enjoy the act of vlogging now. I've been watching some of the top YouTubers, and I've been getting some tips, and I like the idea that you can play with time when you make a video of any kind, and a narrative video particularly. You can play with time scale, you can speed things up a little bit, you can slow it down. It's creative as fuck, and it's so accessible now. The software I use cost me about $100. I use a thing called Corel Video Studio Ultimate, and it does the job nicely. It's got some good effects that I can throw in there. I can change the pace of the video. So if I'm doing some video of driving through the country, which I did in a previous video, I can speed it up and it looks really interesting. I can slow things down. I can reverse videos. There are so many choices. The problem is that I'm kind of putting together maybe 50 pieces of film clip that I've done on various cameras, including the phone. The thing is, you get so much choice that it's really becomes a problem of, I have so many choices, how do I manage this? And what I tend to do is go with my first instinct and follow through on that. And if that doesn't work out, you've got all the other things as options. And I love the creativity of it. I love the fact that it's, in a sense, work. And now that I don't have official work on my plate, I like the idea of sitting down for 6 hours or so and editing video and putting it together and learning while I'm doing it. The beautiful thing about it is that I'm learning a lot. And that's really, really cool. There's a real joy to it. And the creative process, which is kind of similar but not exactly the same as the creative process of doing a podcast, is, you know, just it's something that I'm really drawn to. So I'm going to be doing more of that, which isn't to say I'm going to leave the podcast go, because that's not going to happen. What it means is I'm going to be doing more than one thing. And that's kind of cool. I want to keep the YouTube channel movie related as well, so it'll be accessible for my existing audience, but I want to expand my audience into that area as well. So if you watch YouTube at all, you might want to check that out. And if you don't watch YouTube, it's a perfect opportunity to do it. And that, of course, brings me to the 12 movies that I watched. And they are one movie I'm going to talk about today, Pandora and the Flying Dutchman. Then I did John Woo's The Killer, Devil in a Blue Dress with Denzel Washington, the Jose Ferrer Cyrano de Bergerac, Johnny Cool with Henry Silver, Blade of the Immortal, which was Takashi Miike's 100th movie, The Death and Life of Otto Bloom, of which I will be speaking in this podcast, a movie from 1968, an English kind of giallo almost, called The Psychopath, 1 Million Years BC with Raquel Welch, May Gray Sets a Trap, starring Jean Gabin, based on the novel by Georges Simenon, Black Orpheus, and Emmanuel. So there's a diverse lot of movies there. Three are from non-English speaking cultures. There's the Japanese one, French, and Brazilian. So pretty diverse lot of movies. Apart from that, I've watched The Gorgon, which is a Hammer horror film from the 1960s. I started watching that, but I haven't watched it. But that's about it. That really exhausted me doing 12 movies. It's kind of like, okay, I'm going to take a break now and just kind of watch silly comedy specials on Netflix and YouTube videos on how to do YouTube videos, which is another new addiction of mine. But apart from that, nothing exciting has been happening. I am going to Sydney at the end of this month, being May, to visit my mum for a couple of days. So I'm taking the dreaded train to Sydney and back again and staying with my sister and my brother-in-law and my nephew, which is going to be good. And visiting mum is something important because I'm not sure how many more visits I will get to see her. But it's and I'm going to also vlog that. So that's going to be interesting, making a short film in a sense about an 11-hour train trip to Sydney is going to keep me occupied for the 11-hour train trip to Sydney. So hopefully that'll go well. I'm going to miss Sal. I always miss Sal when I go away on something like this. But I've just got to do it, so I'll just do it. And then next month we've got Continuum, the local science fiction convention over the Queen's birthday weekend in June, which is a 4-day weekend. Sal and I are both going to that. She's going to be selling her crafts there. So if you're out that way, definitely come in and check out her product. And I'm going to be appearing on some panels as well. I haven't got the final list of which panels I've been accepted for. I've asked for a lot of them, but of course then I won't get on all of them because that's the way these things work. And I can talk pretty well and discuss things with people like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and all sorts of other kind of filmic stuff and cultural stuff as well. So that's going to be good. It's also a great opportunity to catch up with a lot of very fine people that I know with whom I only ever catch up at Continuum conventions. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to also try to record a Martian Driving podcast there. I'll see whether that part's been accepted. I may get a 1-hour window for that, or I may get a 2-hour window. Either way, I'm going to do what I can to get it done and do it as well as I can. Take the podcasting gear and just kind of groove on that. So there's a lot of upcoming things that are interesting, some in good ways, some in ways that are a little more serious, but there's stuff to be done there. And I'm enjoying the creative process and enjoying this kind of new phase of my life, which is in some ways very different than the previous one. And it's something that I think that you've got to do when you do retire is you've got to find new things. You've got to get out there, discover new things, learn new things above all else, and embrace whatever comes your way in a totally platonic sense. Okay, so enough philosophizing. It's time to talk about movies. And the reason I'm doing Pandora and The Flying Dutchman in Martian Drive-In rather than Paleo Cinema Podcast is essentially it's a fantasy film, and it sits more comfortably into Martian Drive-In for that reason. So I'm going to start with the trailer and then talk about why I think it's a beautiful film and why it's worth your time.
Is Pandora. She was bold and beautiful, desired by every man who met her. This one risked disaster for her. And this one killed to win her. Pandora destroyed all who loved her until she met the Flying Dutchman.
I'd die for you without the least hesitation. I know that sounds extravagant, but I've thought about it and I mean it. I give up my life for you. That's a measure of my love. And you, what would you give up?
My salvation. I was wrong to respond even for a moment to your to this shocking confession. You seem to forget that you're engaged to marry Stephen Cameron. What makes you imagine that I'd be willing to betray him? The infection of your treachery? I'm immune to that sort of disease. You say you do not destroy things anymore, but you invite me to join you in destroying him. I find the suggestion detestable, and I despise you for making it.
Pandora and the Flying Dutchman is a 1951 English fantasy film, directed and written by Albert Lewin, who only wrote a few movies. He did The Picture of Dorian Gray, amongst others. But he was known more as a writer than he was as a director. But he did get a lot of respect. It was filmed, the cinematographer of the piece was Jack Cardiff. And there have been people around who have said this is one of the most beautifully shot Technicolor films of all time. And I'm not going to argue with them. I mean, you can pick out 50 beautifully shot Technicolor films from Arabian Adventures starring John Hall and Maria Montez to even La La Land. So saying it's one of the most beautiful films ever shot in Technicolor is a kind of a wide statement. It's a bit of a shotgun statement to make, but nonetheless, it is a beautiful film. It stars Ava Gardner as Pandora, James Mason as the Flying Dutchman, Nigel Patrick as one of her love interests, Sheila Sim, Harold Warrender playing an older gentleman with an interest in archaeology and history, and Marius Goring as an ill-fated suitor of Pandora's. The story set in 1930, even though it was made in 51, in a fictional Spanish port town of Esperanza. And some fishermen make a grim discovery in their fishing nets of two people intertwined with each other. As a backstory, the resident archaeologist Jeffrey Fielding, I'm having trouble with words tonight, goes to the beach and he knows who the two people are. They are Pandora Reynolds, played by Ava Gardner, and Hendrik van der Zee, a Dutchman who has a boat anchored in Esperanza's harbour and is a bit of a man of mystery. We cut to a flashback where we see Pandora in an earlier time where she's being played by Ava Gardner, of course, is incredibly beautiful, but is bored with everything. She's self-destructive to her suitors. She's selfish. She gets them to do things in an attempt for her to feel something about them doing things, and that never quite works. And she's one of those women who really doesn't know what she wants and is damaging a lot of people while she tries to find out what that is. She agrees to marry a land speed record holder in car racing, a guy called Stephen Cameron, played by Nigel Patrick. And as she agrees to marry him, she tells him to drive his car off a cliff and push his car off a cliff because she wants some kind of proof that he loves her. She's that kind of a person. He does it and they end up repairing the car, he and his mechanic. But just as that occurs and Pandora and Stephen are about to be married, along comes the mysterious Hendrik van der Zee, and Pandora, naked, swims out to his boat and climbs aboard just to see what's happening. She's intrigued by him. She finds him in the cabin of the boat painting a picture, which turns out to be a picture of her, even though they've never met before, because this is the sort of fantasy film we're talking about. She resembles his lost love, a woman he was married to hundreds of years ago, whom he accused of infidelity inaccurately and killed, and then found out that she wasn't unfaithful at all. He was then brought to justice for it, and as a part of a very angry and kind of self-defeating legal defense, makes an atheist statement and says God doesn't exist, and basically pisses off the judges of the time. And on the evening before his execution, because capital punishment was the sentence for murder at the time, the cell of his door mysteriously opens and none of the prison guards are around. So van der Zee flees to his ship and his crew take it out to sea. He sleeps overnight and wakes up alone on the ship, and he's cursed to sail the seven seas forever. Only once every 7 years is he permitted to make landfall in an attempt to find a woman who loves him so much that she is willing to die for him. And if that's the case, she will die for him and his curse will be lifted. Now, leaving aside the sexual politics of that, not only did he kill his wife, he then has to let another woman die so that he can end his curse. Doesn't seem fair to me. That just doesn't play well to a modern audience. But we'll leave that aside because it's such a beautiful film. And also, Pandora's not much better. Both of them are kind of well-matched in that sense. She allows one of her paramours, played by Marius Goring, to kind of pine for her until the man, having some kind of a depressive issue, poisons himself in a bar where she's singing and playing the piano. And even that doesn't have a long-term effect on her. She seems to be, as Cole Porter once said, fighting vainly the old ennui, until she meets Hendrik van der Zee and they fall in love. Another one of her paramours is a bullfighter called Juan Montalvo, who's arrogant and cocky, as bullfighters often are, and he murders Hendrik out of jealousy. And then when he's having a bullfight the next day, he sees Hendrik walk into the arena because, of course, the Flying Dutchman is cursed to live forever unless a woman dies for him. And he gets gored by a bull and dies. Didn't like him anyway. Doesn't matter. So anyway, this is kind of like the original version of the Thomas Crown Affair, which was called by the director a love affair between two bastards. And in a sense, Pandora and the Flying Dutchman could be looked at with that interpretation. Van der Zee is a kind of person who has committed a violent act against his wife and killed her. And domestic violence is very much a big hot topic issue here in Australia at the moment, rightly so. And Pandora, knowing the ability she has to convince men to do pretty much anything, uses that in a way as a to try to get out of her own funk and her own drifting through life with no purpose and no real passion. So they're well matched in that way, and they kind of overcome that by meeting and falling in love. And it kind of works in spite of the fact that it is a love affair between two bastards. It really does kind of work. The movie is beautiful. The music, I've got to give a bit shout out to the music. I'll just scroll down and take a look at that. It's by a guy called Alan Rawsthorne. And it's very much kind of lyrical and pretty and beautiful. And he also did some music for other movies, The Cruel Sea in 1953, The Captive Heart, School for Secrets, Saraband for Dead Lovers in 1948, which I think is a Stuart Granger movie, West of Zanzibar, that's a great name for a movie, West of Zanzibar, and The Man Who Never Was, and a movie with Howard Keel in it, a very atypical movie for the 50s, with Howard Keel in it called Floods of Fear, which I haven't seen in a long time. But, the whole package really does hold together It takes it has that feel about it, like The Red Shoes and a couple of other Paolo Pressburger movies, where the kind of line between fantasy and reality blurs, and things that aren't of the natural world happen, or at least are perceived to happen. It's very much got that feel, that kind of soft home counties fantasy thing going about it, even though it is, of course, set in Spain. And the locations, by the way, are at a place called Tossa de Mar on the east coast of Spain, about 100 kilometres south of the French border. And the locations are just beautiful. Interestingly enough, in spite of the fact that Pandora and the Flying Dutchman has as one of its subplots bullfighting, Tossa de Mar was the first place in the world in 1989 to declare itself an anti-bullfighting city. So it's got that going for it. But I like this movie a lot. I picked it up, a copy of it, at a shop at the top end of Melbourne CBD called Play. And I paid way too much money for it. But I didn't know another way to get a legal copy of it. And I'm glad I did get a copy of it, because it was the first movie I did in my 23-hour stint over the weekend. And I was swept away by it, in spite of what I've said about the characters. Once you kind of settle in, this movie does sweep you away with the beauty of Ava Gardner and also the complexity of the way she acts. Her character, I mean, Ava Gardner was kind of cursed in a way by being incredibly beautiful, incredibly sexually alluring, something which was paralleled in her own life. But it overshadowed the fact that she was a fine actor. And not at first, but she's kind of one of those people who learned on the job and became a complex and incredibly watchable, even as she aged, actor who never really got the props for that she rightly deserved. James Mason's in there playing the usual slightly stiff James Mason-y role. If there's a weak link in it, he's definitely it. The other person I really like in this film is Harold Warrender, who played Jeffrey, the archaeologist. And he's an older guy with a spade beard, a kind of imperial beard. And he didn't appear in too many movies after this one. Let me just check it out, get the details. He was actually born in 1983. He was in a few things. He was in Ivanhoe and Scott of the Antarctic and a couple of other things, but he died very early at the age of 49. And he was a nice presence in the movie. He kind of grounded the movie in our world, in a sense. He was an archaeologist. He's putting together pieces of pottery that he's found from ancient digs. He's a kind of confidant to a lot of the characters. And he's, even though he does like Pandora, he's not under her spell, in a sense. And I kind of like Harold Warrender's character, Jeffrey, in this one, because he's the person at the start of the movie who breaks the fourth wall and starts telling us the story of Pandora and the Flying Dutchman. And to do that kind of role, you need an actor who's got a kind of likability about him. And I think that Harold Warrender had that. And it really did work for me for that reason. As I said, the Jack Cardiff cinematography is beautiful, as indeed is most of Jack Cardiff's cinematography. Oddly enough, Ava Gardner and he had some discussions about how she was to be lit, because she was a Hollywood star coming into an English movie. By the way, the release of this film was delayed to let her big star film, Showboat, come out. But anyway, Cardiff and her had a conversation about how she wanted to be lit. And the only thing she said was to be careful when she was having her period, because it made her skin slightly chalky. So if you can take that into account, she'd appreciate it. And apparently he did, because she's beautifully lit in this film and breathtakingly beautiful. And there's no doubt in anybody's mind why men in this movie fall in love with Pandora, because Ava Gardner at the time was incredibly stunning, and not just kind of physically beautiful, but there's that something extra that even people like Marilyn Monroe never had. I never found Marilyn Monroe particularly sexy, except in a couple of things like Asphalt Jungle right at the start of her career. But she became almost a caricature, which is one of the reasons why there are so many Marilyn Monroe drag acts, because she herself was something of a caricature of a woman, in at least in the role she played and the role she was given by studios. You don't see many Ava Gardner drag queens for a very special reason. Ava Gardner was a standalone one-off, not caricature, but she was from a very poor background in the South, and she had a natural sexuality that shone through with nothing between her and the camera. And there's an Ava Gardner Museum, by the way, in America somewhere. That'd be a lovely place to visit. But I'm getting off track. I like this film for that reason. I've got a fondness for these kind of films from the middle of the 20th century where they do play fantasy in a way that they don't do now. Now that you can show things with CG and show anything you can imagine, which is great. It's marvelous. I mean, I loved Avengers Infinity War, but this movie played the fantasy aspect subtly and intelligently, and you don't miss for one second the fact that there are no special effects really to convey what they're talking about. I really have a great fondness for this film, and I may well watch it again in a few months, not as a part of a marathon, but just as a standalone with on a quiet day, just sitting there and kind of absorbing it. The only other movie in that marathon that I saw that had the same effect on me was right towards the end when I think it was the second last film I did was Black Orpheus. I've talked about that on Paleo Cinema Podcast. But if I can recommend two of the films that I saw, definitely Pandora and the Flying Dutchman and Black Orpheus, because they're beautiful films. They're both tragedies in a sense, and they take you to another world. And that's one of the virtues that cinema has. It takes you somewhere else and shows you something you haven't seen, and hopefully lets you take something you didn't have inside you with you when you stop watching the movie. So I'm going to end it there for Pandora and the Flying Dutchman. I want to get back and going to talk about an obscure Australian film from 2016, The Death and Life of Otto Bloom.
An Australian psychologist has taken the scientific world by storm following the discovery of a man who experiences time in reverse.
He told me that he was going backwards in time. That what I thought of as the future was actually his past.
They're calling him the human time machine.
So effectively, you've already seen the future.
That's correct.
Right now, there's one name on everyone's lips.
Otto Bloom.
Otto Bloom.
Right, Otto Bloom.
Really, I'm just like anyone else. I'm just moving in the other direction, that's all.
It was as if he knew me better than I knew myself. But with every passing year, he seemed to know me less and less.
Even though Ada and Bloom appeared to be going through life together, they were in fact travelling in opposite directions.
Some critics have accused Otto of having a messiah complex. How do you respond to that?
When I try to imagine what the world must have looked like through his eyes, that's just impossible.
Every moment we ever experience, fleeting though it seems, will forever be unfolding somewhere in time.
A wiser man than myself once said that life can only be understood backwards. And certainly this is true in the case of Otto Bloom.
Always remember you. Always remember you. Always remember
you. I don't do many mockumentaries on the podcast, really. They're a genre that is easy to do badly and difficult to do well. There are a few that work, Spinal Tap, of course, and a number of others. But as a general rule, they are kind of smarty pants filmmaking in a sense. But The Death and Life of Otto Bloom does some things right, and it's not a movie that I remember seeing or hearing about very much, so it didn't get a lot of publicity even here in Australia, where there usually is a certain amount of pushing to get an audience for an Australian film. It came out in 2016. It stars Xavier Samuel as the titular character, We have Rachel Ward playing a character called Ada in her later years, and as a younger woman, she's played by an actor called Matilda Brown. We also get some other kind of interesting characters in there. Terry Camilleri's in there. He's the guy who played Napoleon in the Bill and Ted movie and did a whole bunch of other things. He's been in Mad Max movies. He's been a kind of feature in Australian cinema for a fair while. He's a Maltese-born Australian guy. Not pretty looking, but he's definitely an interesting actor. And a few other local actors, John Gayden, who's a venerable older Australian actor who's done a lot of very accomplished stage work. I think I saw him once in something. In the Nimrod Theatre back in the 1970s and 80s. In the 1980s when I was able to go and see plays for free, John Gayden was in a few of them. Really fine actor, very good at disappearing into a role. Which is not necessarily good for a film actor, but for a stage actor, he is very accomplished. So the story is pretty simple, but complicated at the same time, which is kind of good. Otto Bloom is a guy who appears in Melbourne in 1983 with what appears to be amnesia. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know anything except his name. And he is interviewed in the police station by a young psychologist called Ada. As she interviews him, she realizes that he seems to be living life backwards. There's a moment in the video recording, and it's made to look like an old VHS recording, where he says, "We'll probably talk after the tea lady," and the tea lady comes in. So eventually she comes to the realization that Otto is perceiving time in reverse. He's not time traveling. It's purely a kind of neurological thing in some weird way. But he is living his life in reverse. He remembers the future, but not the past. He appears to be in his mid-20s, and he is in his mid-20s. And by using kind of talking heads, talking to camera, we slowly piece together the life and death and life of Otto Bloom. And this movie, I went in on it cold, as I said, and some movies, it's good to do that. I'm not going to talk about the spoilers in this one. It's a difficult one to podcast about when I come to think of it right now. Good time to realize it. But this one does have surprises, and it's not the kind of story you think it is. Now, there are some kind of thematic similarities between this film and the 2016 film Arrival, as far as the perception of time is concerned and people perceiving time in a different way. If you haven't seen Arrival, see it. It's based on a really good novella by Ted Chiang called Story of Your Life. If you haven't read that, you really should. It's better than the movie, which isn't to say the movie's bad. And it's all kind of posited on the idea that the way we perceive time, going from past to future and living somewhere in the middle of that in what we call the present, that perception of time is merely a perception. It's a neurological thing. It's a perceptual thing, but it's not the reality of the universe. So, interesting concept. And like Arrival, the death and life of Otto Bloom does very much the same thing. But as I said, it's not the kind of story we think it is. As the documentary continues and the talking heads continue, we find out a few things about Otto. He becomes a very accomplished artist. He also becomes a philosopher and does a really large talk, which kind of changes the perceptual universe of humanity by him giving his view that time isn't necessarily from past to future and that we just perceive it that way. And the reality is that, things are not necessarily just happening all at the same time, but past and future don't make any difference in reality. You get a whole bunch of other things coming into play with the character. The fact that as time progresses, his art becomes worse. It doesn't become better, but because he's living his life perceptually in reverse, his skill as an artist decreases over time rather than increases. And his relationship with Ada, they do form a relationship. kind of diminishes over time because she's in the bit where she really, you know, she's comfortable with the relationship. They've been together for a fair while. And yet for him, it's like the relationship gets newer and newer as time gets on rather than older and older and more comfortable. And then one day he just walks out because for him, that's the start of the relationship. He then forms a relationship with somebody else who may be a gold digger, using the fact that she knows Otto's past as a way of kind of getting into his life and being a part of that. And they get a nice big house in Dalesford, about 150 kilometres from here. And he becomes something of a recluse because you've got to remember he's living his life in reverse. The more time goes on, the less he knows. So he gets a kind of temporal dementia over time. And eventually he dies prematurely at the hand of somebody else, which isn't too much of a spoiler for the film because the core of the film isn't something I'm going to tell you about. It's something else entirely. Now, the acting in it is pretty good. Xavier Samuel as Otto Bloom doesn't quite, for me, nail it. I think that that's a bit of a shame. And also, it's a hard kind of character to get a tab on, a character who's living their life in reverse and perceiving things at 180 degrees to the way we as an audience and the other characters are perceiving it. It's a big ask to kind of convey that. So, again, the writing is on point and the writing is good, but it's a very difficult role to nail down. Rachel Ward playing the older Ada who does the interview to camera, and a lot of the perceptions about Otto are from what she tells us and reveals about herself and her life and the way that this strange kind of reversed relationship with Otto has changed her life. Rachel Ward is fantastic in this. She really does give us a complex female character. She gives us somebody who's profoundly affected by her love for Otto and yet has been very damaged by it. And there's a really interesting arc there. Again, I don't want to do too many spoilers, but there's a grace note in the last 10 minutes of the film that makes it really worthwhile and worth checking out. So in essence, this is a pretty simple story. The movie runs 84 minutes, so it's not a really long one. The premise doesn't kind of wear out its welcome at all, but it does give us that reminder, and which I really love getting, that to do a good science fiction film, you don't necessarily need a fortune in special effects, a story told on an enormous scale, and a cast of 100 characters. You just need to have good story, good actors, and in a way you need to show us something we haven't seen before. And that this movie delivers on that. It's surprisingly how affected I was by the end of the film, and I love that. I love the fact that I went on this one cold. I bought a copy of the disc on eBay for ridiculous dollars, ridiculously small dollars, I should say, and I kind of got rewarded for it. It's like a while back, there are some books I bought, books of essays and things like that that I bought, which cost me a dollar. I bought one book of essays called The Singer and the Songs by a guy called Gene Lees, who was a music writer. And The Singer and the Songs, the essays in that book, taught me more about music and how music is made and the nature of music than any 50 other books I've read. And it cost me a dollar. It was at a street market in St. Kilda a long time ago. I still got the copy of it. And I love it. It goes into all sorts of interesting things like why French love songs are better than English love songs. And there is actually a linguistic reason for that. But to get to my point, things you pick up cheaply sometimes can be the most valuable. And taking a chance and taking a punt on a movie that, you know, may disappoint you. There's always that possibility when you don't know anything about a movie. There's no social media buzz about it. You know some of the actors, but not all of them. You know a vague premise, but you really don't in depth have a lot of info about this film. Sometimes they pay off, and they pay off often enough to make it worth doing. And this movie is definitely one of those films. It does pay off. And I hope Netflix pick it up if they haven't already, and that it does get a wider audience, because small films like this, which kind of tell stories on, and in a sense, this is a movie on a global scale as well, because he does become a core celeb, and there's a lot of social media stuff about him. There's a lot of newspaper stuff. There are misperceptions of who he is and why he lives his life the way he does, because a lot of people can't get their head around the idea of somebody living their life in reverse. And so he's castigated by the newspapers when he breaks up the relationship with Ada. All of those kind of things play into this. So there are little bits and pieces there of the nature of celebrity, the nature of misinterpreting the acts, motivations, and nature of other human beings once they become celebrities. And there's also, you know, the nature of falling in love, building a relationship, and how that affects people's lives. And increasingly, I like films like this. In a sense, a big budget, large scale science fiction movie with lots of set piece action sequences and surprising bits and all those other kind of things that you might get in, say, Avengers Infinity War. They're like an all-you-can-eat buffet. You pick out what you like and you just stuff yourself silly with it. You can gorge on the chicken wings if you want to, or the ribs, or you can go with a salad, or you can even just eat all the bread rolls out of it. One way or the other, you're going to get filled and you're going to feel satisfied by it. These little movies like this, I like those little canapes you find. You know, you're going through a party and then someone brings out a tray of something and you try it, and it's an intense moment of flavor, and you go, oh geez, they're good. I couldn't eat a lot of them, but they're intensely flavored. They're surprising in the mixtures of flavors that are in them. They're made very well, and they're an immediate kind of blip of satisfaction that you get. This movie's like that compared to a larger scale science fiction movie. It's a small, intense, complex in some ways, little canopy of a movie, which is worth checking out. And it's a great reminder of that small scale science fiction movies are sometimes a lot of fun. Another example I can use from 70 years ago almost is a movie like The Man in the White Suit. Simple concept, played through to the end, played amusingly by Alec Guinness and Joan Greenwood and the other characters in it. But it's a small scale science fiction movie which talks about larger themes, and this movie is very much in that vein. There's not too much to say about it. I really don't want to get into the spoiling the heart of the movie, but it does end in a very satisfying way, and that's always going to make a movie worth your while when you're kind of happy at the end of it. You see what they were trying to do. They've achieved it, and they've surprised you too. Small-scale science fiction movies don't often have the ability to surprise us, particularly when they use a format like a mockumentary, which is almost a cliche these days. But this one does have that kind of little bit extra that makes it worth checking out. So that's about it for the podcast. I've got to do a shout out to good friend in Minnesota, David Kummer, for subscribing via Patreon and throwing some money at me. David and I met a long time ago, and he's one of the good people. And thank you to all the other subscribers as well. Thank you to the people who watch the YouTube channel, which you should check out. If you type my name into YouTube and maybe type in 24 movies, you're going to find the channel. So if you want to subscribe to that as well, that's cool. I'm going to try to put a lot more content. Most of it's going to be movie related, which is cool. I'm going to also vlog. I'm not sure if I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, because I recorded half of this podcast yesterday. But I'm going to vlog my trip to Sydney, and I'm going to try to make it movie-related as much as I can, but I'm going to be doing a YouTube vlog of that, so that's going to be cool for me. Anyway, look after yourselves. Watch bad movies, watch good movies. Keep watching the skies. Don't let the bastards grind you down. This isn't a dystopia unless we all agree it is. So, as usual, at the end of the podcast, there are the credits done in the style of movie credits to honour the wonderful Patreon supporters. I'll catch you guys later. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.